Game on 2FM.
With Gillette. Great performances begin with a comfortable close shave from Gillette. Gillette, making men's lives just that little bit easier.
Game on 2FM.
Weekdays from 7.
So how's Blue Monday for you? Well, it's nearly over, and for the next hour you can stick around the company of me, John Kenny, in for Hugh Cahill this Monday night here on Game On. We'll be hearing shortly from Shane Lowry, showing his nerves of steel to win in Abu Dhabi and shoot up the rankings as well. We'll be talking to Alan Cawley, who's in studio. Good evening to you, Alan. How
evening,
are you?
John.
And how was your weekend?
Very good. Excellent. As always, yeah.
Talking about the transfer window, but the Premier League the weekend, it looks like it's the top three, really, isn't it? Liverpool, City, maybe even two. Or Spurs,
I think it's two now, yeah.
Probably two, yeah.
Yeah.
We'll also talk to Alan, along with Jack Pitbrook, who's the football journalist in The Independent. Talking rugby tonight, Irish progression in the Champions Cup, sail away for Connacht, injury latest ahead of the Six Nations as well. Don Lennon will give us the update. And did you stay up and watch the American football? You're not an American football
John,
fan. And I love American football. It was fantastic last night. Now, I didn't get up to say stay up for the second game because I just come in from holidays, but the first game was extraordinary.
As a good friend of mine, John, surely you should know at this stage, NFL and me, zero interest.
Anyway, we will have an eye on America on a Monday with Jeff Shepherd. That's to come up just a little shortly. Now, you probably heard over the last couple of days, we laid to rest our good friend and colleague Alan McQuillan today, who left this mortal coil age just 36. Great, kind, understanding lad. For Alan, radio was everything. He loved being part of the Radio Centre family here in RTÉ. And of course, he did occasionally work on Game On when we're outside broadcasting. On a personal note, Alan and I were good mates. We would chew the fat just about how our lives were going, not only our careers, on many occasions. To his parents, Anne and Robert, brother Ian, who I met yesterday at the family home in Finglas, and sister Yvonne, aunts and uncles, cousins, work colleagues, and a huge circle of friends, we send our deepest condolences from all here on Game On. Yesterday, Gareva Annam, it's going to be a sad loss. It's only 36 years of age.
Extremely sad, John, yeah. Great news, lad. And it's very sad for everyone here.
Indeed. But life moves on. You're a golf fan. You're not an NFL fan, but you certainly are a golf fan.
NFL, I know we're joking about it, but it's amazing on Sunday nights, because I follow obviously a lot of Twitter or sports people on Twitter, but the following it has over here, because Sunday nights becomes NFL night on Twitter.
Oh, yeah. I went into discussions with a couple of my colleagues, Rory O'Neill and Kevin Corcoran.
I saw them all night, non-stop. You, Kevin Corcoran, Rory O'Neill. I was like, all right, give it a rest, lads.
Yeah, come on, we're loving it. Loving it. Come on.
But it's good.
This kind of stuff. It's great, yeah. And I like the interaction of it as well, I must say, yeah.
Yeah, because that's what, like, look, people each to their own. It's something I never got into. Everybody tells me it's such a great game, but that's one thing I've certainly noticed on Sunday nights, the amount of people, Irish people and all sports people here, has a huge following, everybody engaging in it, and non-stop discussion on it.
Yeah. Two sports that you would definitely watch over the weekend. You watched the Masters, I presume.
Glued.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Some win by Trump, wasn't it?
He was brilliant. He was the player of the tournament all week, John. He fully deserved it. Obviously, Ronnie is on an unbelievable run and destroying everybody at the moment.
The margin of victory says a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, and as they were saying on BBC last night in the coverage, it was a coming of age for Trump, because myself and Hugh spoke about it last Wednesday, was it? Obviously, it was mid-tournament and Trump started really well. He beat Kyron Wilson 6-2, and we were basically discussing that for all the talent he has, it's about time he delivered on a really big stage, which is obviously one of the triple majors. And I think it was the UK Open he won back in 2011, but he hasn't won a big one since. But for him to win that, and as you say, the manner of the victory, particularly against Ronnie, it will give him some confidence, especially going into the World Championships in April. So I was delighted for him, because I think it shows to everybody else as well, John, that Ronnie is beatable. Because there was a period there, I felt, recently in snooker, for as good as Ronnie is, and he's amazing, the best that we'll ever see, it was almost getting to the stage where lads were beaten before he even went out on the table against him.
Yeah, of course.
But certainly in this tournament, and obviously Trump with the way he beat him in the final, I think it sends a message to everybody else that he is beatable. And if you put in the hours, which Trump has changed, I think, his whole mindset, and he's practiced heavily throughout the last 6 months, it just goes to show. And he was brilliant in yesterday in the first session, and obviously he finished it up last night as well.
Yeah, he's the Trump we like.
He's the Trump we love.
indeed. And Larry,
unbelievable.
Yeah, that's what's his fourth tournament victory, which started with the Irish Open 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Shut him up the rankings, $1 million. Great boost.
Oh, it was brilliant, John. Again, we were discussing it as it was going on, and he was playing so well and we were hoping he could get the job done. And the fact that it finished early on Saturday, normally the tournaments obviously finish on the Sunday, so it was brilliant again for everybody, because the time difference, it was Saturday morning and it finished at 1 o'clock on Saturday afternoon, so I'd say the whole country was glued to it. I actually switched it off when he went three behind, I'll be honest.
Thinking it was
to
over.
Say, I did think it was over.
You're
yeah.
kind of fan that leaves the match 10
no,
minutes
No, not really,
the
no,
end.
But it did
no,
look
actually,
like
you're
it,
not, fairness.
It did look like it was.
And you switched it off.
It wasn't so much that you thrown it away. It was because the other lad was playing so well. He was playing really, really well. Sterney got off to an absolute flyer. I think he had four birdies after the first five holes. And it just seemed as though it wasn't happening for Shane. But I think that was what was so impressive about the victory. To fall, to obviously have the lead going into it, to fall so far behind, because he went down, I think, by four shots on the 11th. And from to turn it all around, and then it was so impressive on the 18th. And he's a great lad as well, as everybody knows, or anyone who's met him. He's such a humble, down-to-earth lad. Everybody, he's so likeable. Everybody loves Shane, really. And he has gone through a bad period for the last couple of years. Bo, obviously, on his bag, who we all know as well. And it was just a brilliant victory, and it sets him up great for 2019.
Well, you mentioned the way it finished on a Saturday, middle of the afternoon. Today, Shane was talking to the Race to Dubai show, and he said, yeah, I went and celebrated.
Yeah, we had a bit of a party on Saturday night, but I was quite tired after that, and I went then yesterday to watch a bit of the rugby on TV and had a few drinks and tried to celebrate as good as I could. And yeah, I'm obviously very happy. It's been obviously a great week, and yeah, just trying to enjoy it.
How many Irish expats live in Abu Dhabi?
Quite a few. I think every one of them was out there on Sunday, but it was, look, it was great. Obviously, wherever we go, there's a lot of Irish people, and there are a lot of people out watching me on Sunday, and they gave me a good hand in winning. It's a weird golf course, because it looks like you kind of need to hit a lot of fairways to shoot good scores, but you kind of just need to know where to miss it. I think if you miss the fairways on the right side, you have chances of hitting it in close enough so you can make birdie. So I think you just need to be somewhat clever about how you play the golf course. But if you start missing on the wrong side of fairways, then you start getting trouble and you start to struggle to shoot good scores. But obviously, like, every time we play there, the scoring is quite good. And then some years you just go there and you're, you know, first tournament of the year for most people, and some people are a bit rusty and you're just kind of like playing average and shooting level par or one over, and you're obviously going to miss the cut with two of those. And just one of those weeks where, you know, you just need to kind of miss them on the right side and get a bit fortunate every now and then as well. I felt like the course was playing difficult on Saturday, and obviously Richard got off to an absolute flyer, but that's the type of thing you can do on that golf course. And look, I just tried to hang in as much as I could, and I was lucky enough to get the job done after that. But I knew at some stage it might become more difficult. I kept on saying to myself, he can't keep doing this, and luckily enough for me, he didn't. You know, I bogeyed 11 and I was struggling going to the 12th tee. I was a bit annoyed, and I kind of just said to myself, you know what, I'm not sure if it's going to be my day, but I'll do my best for the next seven holes and see where it leads me after that. And fortunate enough to go and play the last seven holes well and get the job done.
Going down the last hole, have you ever hit two better shots under the cosh than you did at the 18th, the par 5?
I was very happy and very impressed with myself for the tee shot I hit. You know, a lovely little low fade down there. And then the wind was nicely out of the left for the second shot, and I had a good number on my tree wood, and I just, you know, stood up and said to myself, just hit it hard and make sure not to miss it right, because right wasn't great. But just hit two beautiful shots. Obviously, I was very happy with that, and, you know, managed to go up and two put it as well. So probably the tree was probably one of the best shots I've ever hit, to be honest.
Shane, the sort of 2.5 years before this has been a bit of a tough time for you on the course. How have you sort of kept your sort of confidence throughout that period?
Yeah, like, look, I went, you know, I played in America a lot over the last couple of years, and my results have not been great, and I just struggled a little bit. And, you know, your confidence does take a big knock when you're not performing to how you feel you should be. And I suppose I have plenty of good people around me, like my wife and my coach and family, and, you know, they kind of keep you going, and I'm doing, you know, you're doing it all for them, really. That kind of keeps you going and keeps you getting up every day and working at it. And look, I knew I was never that far away, but to be honest, I was coming out last week and I didn't think, obviously I knew I had a chance, if I played well I could win, but I didn't think I was going to, because it was, you know, normally takes me a little while to get stuck into the season. Obviously my schedule is going to change a little bit over the next while. The big events are in America, you know, I'll be obviously in the WGCs and majors now, so yeah, I'll be going playing in those, but I definitely been a lot more events in Europe than I have done the last few years, and I've made that decision at the start of the year and I'm going to stick by it. I think it's too hard of an ask for me personally to play on both tours. You know, for the very top players in the world, I think it's doable for those because they're in all the big tournaments and, you know, they're obviously so good. But I think for me, at the stage of my career I'm at, I don't think playing both tours is the way forward.
Shane Larry speaking to the Race to Dubai podcast today. Great win, we mentioned that already. He's got to kick on though, really. I mean, it's four tournament victories over the last while. Of course, tournaments, you know, they're difficult to win. But he's got the undoubted ability, isn't he? There's no undoubted ability.
I don't think his ability was ever in question, John. Yeah, sometimes you just go through periods of your career when it's just not happening for you. And he finished the season pretty well, if I remember, last year. So maybe that was a help as well.
Yeah.
And he probably felt good about his game over the Christmas. I think what was impressive too, he went out very early with Paul Dunn and put in a lot of practice for this tournament as well. So that obviously stood to him. And he's very honest there, I think, as you would expect with Shane. He just tells it as it is, and I suppose as he was making the comment that playing in America maybe didn't suit him, and he's made the decision to play a bit more tournaments in Europe. I think the fact that his wife and his little kid as well was over there at the weekend probably relaxed him. The experiences he's gone through in the bigger tournaments when he was four ahead going into the final round, all that would stand to him as well going into this, John, and he just seems to be in a much happier place. And he's a great lad, as we said, so hopefully, and I think, as far as I know, he's very good friends with Padraig Harrington, and obviously with him now, the Ryder Cup captain, he must have that in his sights. And wouldn't it be brilliant for him to be on the team with Padraig captain in it?
One of the texts in 51552 Packy from Summerhill. Well done, Shane Larry, for his mental bottle shown. He had it won before he started. He was beaten at half time when he showed class to win it. Proud of him and his family. Well done, Packy from Summerhill. So say all of us. Actually, it's funny enough, just as a little aside, I'm in a little society playing for golf, and they gave us this today. New rules of golf. Did you realise these ones?
Well, there was a few of them as they...
You have 3 minutes, not 5 minutes, to search for your lost ball.
Oh, you're goosed there,
I'm goosed there completely. Here's another one I'm goosed. If you accidentally move the ball, say, with your trolley or stand on your ball while searching for it, you simply replace the ball from its original position without penalty.
Okay.
That's happened a couple of times. All drops, whether free drop, penalty drop, or from GOR or ground under repair, they call it, are now taken from knee heights.
Yeah. Normally you would drop there was a couple of them in the tournament.
Yeah,
the
so you got to get down your knee, well, down towards your knee. And finally, you may now put with the flag stick in the hole. Mm-hmm. And we did that today. If your ball strikes the flag stick, you next play from where it comes to rest.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I don't know. I'm rubbish, so I haven't a clue. I wouldn't hit the hole nor the flag stick.
Hugh's good at the golf.
Hugh's good at the golf, indeed. Yeah. I played with Hugh a couple of times. Well,
Hugh's
actually, I've walked around with a stick in my hand. He's been
not bad,
playing.
Yeah.
So, but there's pros and anti's, and some of the good golfers were saying that keeping the flag stick in is a good idea.
Yeah, Paul McGinley was on commentary, obviously, with Sky, and there was a couple of those new rules popped up, and he was explaining them. There was one, what was the one he was dead against? And his co-commentator was for it, and Paul was arguing.
Well, they're the four major changes, that one.
Yeah, he was dead against one of them.
Probably the flag in the hole.
I don't think it was. It was something to do with the spike marks, that you can replace the spike marks now. And
repair them, yeah.
Yeah, repair them. And he didn't agree with that, Paul.
It used to be pitch marks you could repair, but nothing else. So spike marks maybe are in now. So.
Because the argument he was making was something was that, yeah, everybody has to be on the same level playing field, that if you have people who are going out in the last group and there's already been 20 groups have gone ahead of them, they don't get the best of conditions as the first. But Paul McGinley was saying, well, look, that's just the nature of the game. And
sure. Well, we'll talk more about that with Gary and Greg tomorrow here on Game On. But we're going to talk Premier League weekend, the transfer window latest, and a bit about Ronaldo as well. I'll tell you about that in a second. Alan's been joined by Jack Pitt-Brook, the football journalist for The Independent. Hello, Jack. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Good. Mentioned at the top of the programme, and now there were three. Is it now there were two? You think, for the Premier League, Liverpool, Man City, have Spurs any chance?
Not yet. I think Spurs will eventually fall away, but they're still doggedly hanging in there. It was such an important win for them to beat Fulham on Sunday, and you can see that from the celebrations of Pochettino and the substitutes when Harry Winks scored that header. But I think ultimately they just don't have the strength and depth that City and Liverpool do. I mean, they've got this huge game against Chelsea on Thursday, and they don't have Harry Kane, Dele Alli, all Heung-min Son, their three best attacking players. So I think that eventually that kind of, the lack of resources they have and the fact they've only really got sort of 12, 30 core players they can rely on is eventually going to kill them.
You'd agree, Alan?
Yeah, up until last week, I was still giving them a small chance, John. But once the injuries occurred, obviously to Harry Kane, Son being away, Dele Alli gets injured yesterday, I just can't see it. And I'm mad about Spurs, and I did give them a little squeak, but they just can't cope with the losses of those three especially. And yeah, it will be between City and Liverpool.
Yeah, I look at some of the remaining fixtures actually here, lads. Liverpool's next couple of fixtures: Leicester home, West Ham away, Bournemouth home before they play United. City have got Newcastle away, Arsenal home, Chelsea home. So City's games over the next while, next three anyway, are more difficult, it would appear, than Liverpool. So it may be a chance for the Reds to start pulling away.
Yeah, I think City are going to have. I think City will probably have to win basically every remaining game to have a chance of winning the title, just because Liverpool have a slightly easier running than they do, and Liverpool aren't going to drop that many points. So City can't really afford to drop any more, because I can't see them clawing it back if they let the gap get to 10 or 7, 8 or 9 points again.
Yeah, and they don't play each other again either, so that's a plus from Liverpool's point of view, I suppose. Their run-in, last couple of games, Cardiff away, Huddersfield home, Newcastle away, Wolves at home. It's not daunting, really, is it?
Well,
no.
Go on, Jack.
Sorry, no, I mean, Liverpool have managed to get over the line quite impressively in their last two games. Brighton away, which I went to the Palace game at Anfield the other day. So, I mean, at the moment, they're looking like they're not too affected by nerves. It'll be interesting to see if that changes as they get closer to the finishing line.
Yeah,
I think, though, John, with the Premier League, and I'm not sure if Jack agrees, but there's a lot of cannon fodder in the league as well. Poor enough teams. Like, I know, obviously, they've played Brighton and Crystal Palace, who I would put in that category, and it has been tricky, and they've only won by the odd goal.
Well, in fairness to Palace, they were brilliant against City away. I mean, that was a fantastic result.
I think there's a lot of cannon fodder in the league. So you're looking at to see where they're going to draw points. It's only against them top teams as such and the top six, and Liverpool's running is by far the easier, you would say, and up to now they've been so impressive. I give them an unbelievable chance. I know people are suggesting City, that since the defeat, obviously they've responded really well and they look very impressive, but Liverpool have been outstanding all year.
And do you think it's done?
I wouldn't say it's done by any means. It'll be tight, but I think Liverpool are in an absolutely unbelievable position. The gap of 4 points, the running is better. I think they've a far better all round team. I'd just be fearful if they were to lose Van Dijk. I think they're coping just about at the moment with the losses of the likes of Lovren and Trent Alexander-Arnold, and they can kind of afford with those couple of losses. But if they were to lose someone like Van Dijk, obviously defensively, and maybe Salah up top, but I think, like, I know Klopp, and obviously there's going to be a bit of apprehension and nerves because it's been so long, and that's only natural.
1990,
but they've coped with it so well, and they've been outstanding. They've been absolutely brilliant all season, Liverpool. Klopp's done an amazing job.
Yeah, I mean, and it's amazing to watch actually on Twitter, Jack, Liverpool supporters going, hang on, don't give it to us yet. It's just, as Anna mentioned, it's been so long that they're not counting their chickens before they hatch now. And I suppose they're right to do. They just play a cautious game at this stage. You know, don't go too gung-ho. It's back, despite the fact that they're playing so well.
Yeah, and I'm sure they'll be scarred by the memory of 2014, where they were top with a few games left and everybody thought they were going to do it. And then that famous game against Chelsea where they messed it up, I think in part you can put that down to the pressure and expectation of all the Liverpool fans. So I think, I wonder whether Liverpool fans might realise that they have a role to play here as well, and they can't burden the players with too much pressure. Because they know that maybe the players won't be able to stand up for it. They need to be a bit more relaxed just to allow the players to play. Because if they keep playing the natural game, then they'll win the title. Yeah. No problem.
Do you think there'll be any dealings in the transfer window, though, for City and Liverpool?
Liverpool, no, I don't think so. City have been looking around for a left-back because, you know, Mendy's had this kind of new knee problem. He is coming back, but I think City will probably not want to do anything unless they could add anything big. I think more likely to see action at Chelsea, who are obviously going for Gonzalo Higuain up front, and maybe at Tottenham.
Yeah. Do you think both sides need to strengthen, Anna?
Who, Liverpool and City?
Yeah.
No, I think they're fine.
Yeah.
Obviously, they're very good squads, strength and depth. As I say, if they were to get an injury to the likes,
but we've got 11 days before the end of the transfer window,
exactly.
but it's very quiet at the moment, isn't it? I mean,
yeah, but
it's not a lot of names being bandied
about.
But
I don't think it's a great time to buy players, to be honest with you, John. You know, and especially they have obviously established first 11s or first kind of 12, 13, whatever you want. So they don't really need to be upsetting the apple cart. Or I don't think there's any great need for them to be bringing in anyone either of those two. Certainly, there's a need for Chelsea because we watched them the other night. Obviously, there's big news with Sarri coming out and having a go at the players.
What did you think of that? I actually thought he was quite measured in what he said.
I'd sound like a hypocrite now because I've slaughtered Mourinho for doing that kind of stuff, but I think it's not like for like. Mourinho was just negative on everything.
But he would pick on individual players, and he did Pogba, and he'd mentioned Rashford as well. He mentioned individual. Sarri seems to do this as a collective.
And I like Sarri, and I think the reason he's been doing it as a collective, because then players have gotten away with a lot now. If you think, obviously, they did it with Mourinho, they did it with Conte. Here we go again now with another manager claiming that they're hard to motivate. Now people are coming back with the argument that it's up to him to motivate them. But sometimes I feel sorry for the modern day manager, because if the players feel like they don't want to play or they're just no interest, they're just down tools, and you're never going to get a case
United,
where you can get rid of 12, 13 players. The manager is always the one who suffers. We've seen something similar at Leicester City as well with Ranieri. So I think this is becoming a little bit of a common problem, and particularly with those Chelsea players. So in some ways I admire him for standing up to them and maybe having a go at them. Now, the argument is he gambling massively? Because once you come out and criticise players in public, it always ends a bit disastrously.
Yeah, but he doesn't name names.
But where he doesn't have a leg to stand on in some ways is he has to look at himself, and the decision to play Hazard in the position he's playing him is absolute ludicrous. He's the best player, I would go so far as saying, in the league, never mind in Chelsea's team, in his proper position, and he's got off to a great start at the start of the season playing off Giroud. To play him in the position that he's playing him now, John, you're not getting the best out of him, and it's not helping the team. He's also playing Jorginho, and I understand why he's playing him, because the style of football that Sarri wants to play, he wants a ball player picking it up off the back four and starting the attacks, whereas he feels Kante is just that defensive shield, but technically he's not as good as Jorginho. But again, it's taken away from the team, because the first thing people are throwing at him is, well, Kante is the best defensive shield in the league, and you're playing him in a position where it's not helping the team and it's not helping him. So there's two areas where I think Sarri has to look at himself, but certainly coming out having a go at them, I'd have a little bit of a sympathy on him. I think fair play to him.
Yeah, what do you think, Jack?
Yeah, I agree. I do have sympathy with Sarri, but he's certainly taken a huge risk. I mean, plenty of Chelsea managers in the past have tried to go to war with the dressing room, and it doesn't usually work well. And of course, the real problem is that even though he's attacking the players, his future rests with the players. Like, Chelsea are not going to like endorse him having a big clear out in January and getting rid of all the bad eggs and spending $300 million revamping the squad. That's not really how Chelsea work. But they're more short-term than that. They like to keep the players in place and change the manager. And if the players really aren't having Sarri, and if the players are upset and offended by what Sarri said, then they can just down tools and get him sacked. So he's...
It's the point Adam was making.
He backed himself into a corner.
On it, Jack, like, you mentioned bad apples there. I look around that squad, and in fairness to them, I don't see any bad apples. So I wonder, is it more of a case of the point Sarri was making was, he just finds the mentality of those players that they're not kind of blood and guts, that they're not really self-motivated, or they're hard to motivate, and that's just the style of them as people maybe and as players, whereas I don't think they're necessarily bad apples.
I think you're probably right. I think that they've lost a lot of the leaders that they've had in recent years. I mean, not even just the kind of Lampard, Terry, Drogba, Cech generation, but even in the last few years, like Cahill's effectively gone, Diego Costa, Cesc Fabregas, Nemanja Matic, you know, the big players from the second Mourinho title and the Antonio Conte title season have gone. And now it is quite a quiet group, even though there's some experience. There aren't that many leaders. And that, I think, is probably the problem, is that there aren't players who, you know, Sarri wants a strong dressing room. He can kind of meet him halfway, and he's not got that.
It's been an intriguing season so far anyway, gentlemen. Before I let you go, Jack, have you heard the story about Cristiano Ronaldo? Ronaldo apparently will be given a hefty fine, anything up to €19 million, and a 2-year suspended sentence, apparently tomorrow, from image rights generated when he played for Real Madrid. Have you heard that story?
Yeah. We carried it on our website early this afternoon. I think it's a bit of a long-running scam, really, with footballers and image rights. You know,
he's not the first by any stretch. No.
Yeah, they like these image rights deals because it's income which isn't described as income, right? Like you can get it, but you maybe don't have to pay tax on it the same way. And everyone knows in football that for years players have been raking it on image rights deals. And finally, I think the after being quite lax on it in the past, Spanish prosecutors are now realising that they've been, in fact, they've been denied millions of euros that are rightfully theirs. So kind of fair play to them for trying to claw that money back.
Yeah, well, he's going to be in the spotlight tomorrow because the judge has said no special treatment, you're coming through the front door on foot. So he'll be there in the glare of publicity tomorrow.
Yeah. It's always a bit odd when you see these people who are, you know, kind of live their life as gods, having to go and have these kind of menial court appearances.
Yeah, mix it with the mere mortals. Yeah.
Yeah, quite.
Jack, listen, thanks for joining us there. That's Jack Pitbrook from The Independent, and Alan Colley in studio, but he's going to stay with us until 8 o'clock tonight. We're going to talk rugby after these.
Game on 2FM.
With Gillette. New skin guard sensitive with unique skin guard technology, taking the pressure off the blades and your shave. Say bye to shave irritation. Gillette, the best a man can get.
John Kenny on Game On until 8 o'clock tonight. Keep your text coming in, 51552, 51552. Before we talk Don Lenehan and rugby the weekend, Portlaoise's TJ Donaghy made a successful defence of his IBF World Super Bantamweight title with an 11th round stoppage of Takashi from Japan at Madison Square Garden. Immediately reiterated his desire for a unification fight. Having secured the world title last August, the Portlaoise man now sets his sight on the WBA Super Bantamweight champion, Danny Roman. Here's what Donaghy had to say after the fights.
Daniel Roman here tonight is another piece of that title. Is that the fight you want next?
That's the fight I want next. That's what we're all in it for. Danny Roman's a great fighter. He's got the WBA belt. I've got the IBF. Danny, if you're here, I haven't seen you yet, but if you want to get it off.
Oh. I was going to say, we can bring him in. Danny, what did you think of the performance?
Congratulations on your win. Tough opponent. Now that that's over, let's make it happen, a unification from champion to champion. Let's give the best fight and let the best win.
Eddie, you heard it. You got the orders from the fighters. Let's go. Let's dance.
And let's hear a lot more from TJ over the next while. Congratulations to him. And I mentioned rugby. What a weekend. European quarterfinals in the Champions Cup. Saracens against Glasgow. Racing 92 against Toulouse. Leinster against Ulster. And it's Edinburgh against Munster. Ties to be played on the weekend of March the 29th to the 31st. It will be determined by television, of course. Champions Cup. Brilliant. Sale Sharks against Connacht. It means all four provinces, Don Lenehan, have qualified for the knockout stages of their respective tournaments. One heck of a weekend for the Irish provinces, wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, it's been incredible, John. I mean, Irish rugby's on a fantastic journey at the moment, but for all four provinces to make it to the quarterfinals of their respective tournaments was a brilliant achievement, especially given that especially in the case of Munster, Ulster and Connacht, they really had to fight to get over the line in the end. You know, it was anticipated that Leinster would win against Wasps, and they did so with a really impressive performance. But overall, a brilliant weekend. Another brilliant weekend.
Indeed. Is there anything there to stop Leinster, do you think, at the moment?
Well, look, there's a long way to go between now and the quarterfinals in the end of March. Racing haven't been as impressive in the last few weeks as they had been earlier in the season, but Saracens, I feel, are the real danger to Leinster in terms of retaining their crown. They won't meet, of course, until the final, given that they're on the opposite sides of the draw. But you know, Saracens, after you know, a lot of injury issues last year, they seem to be back to their best. But look, once you get to this stage of the tournament, it's going to be very competitive. Injuries, as we've seen already, are going to play a huge part. And you know, you look at Munster, Leinster, even Racing have a lot of players in the French squad. Saracens give a huge amount of their key players to the England squad. And these quarterfinals are going to take place just 2 weeks after the Six Nations, so it doesn't give a huge margin for error for any players carrying knocks. So a lot can change between now and then.
Indeed, yeah. What about Munster's performance? It was, I know, a team that they drew with initially in the first game in that pool, but they really had to dig out a performance to get a result, didn't they? I mean, did that impress you the way, I mean, I suppose it's Munster of old, isn't it? Kind of dig into the trenches kind of stuff, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. But look, this was always going to be a really difficult game. The problem for Munster is the way Exeter play. They're almost a carbon copy of Munster. They're really strong physically. You know, they have a very good maul defensively. They're very well organised, and they're ruthless at the breakdown. You go back to the game in Sandy Park in the opening round. Nothing between the sides. They end up finishing 10-all. So, like, over the course of the two games, only 2 points separating them. But it was incredible, really, when you look at the stats of the game. I don't think Munster would ever have won a game in Thomond Park before with as little as 36% of possession, and even less in terms of territory. They were behind Exeter in all the key areas of metres gained, carries, defenders beaten, yet they still came out on top. So look, that age-old fighting spirit was there. A couple of vital moments, a line-out steal from Billy Holland, you know, just after coming onto the field. It looked, you could hear the groan in the crowd when Tadhg Byrne had to go off with that knee injury. And then Holland comes on and has this miraculous interception in the line-out, given that Exeter Maul had been so strong. And, you know, hats off to Joey Carberry. You go back to that game against Cast, a lot of focus was on him and the fact that he missed three kicks, but his performances since, four games, 20 kicks in a row, and that kick at the end wasn't easy by any manner of means. There was a swirling wind there, but he just looked so composed, and you know, he delivered on the biggest stage.
Byrne, obviously, that injury you mentioned there, that's a knock-on effect for Ireland. He's out for the first two games, at least, in the Six Nations. Quinn Roo is in. There is one or two injury problems for Joe Smith, which we'll allude to in the second. But Ulster, just quick mention, they will be playing Leinster in the next round. I heard Morning Ireland this morning, Paddy Wallace saying he rates Ulster's chances. But with the strength and depth that Leinster have, do you think that's possible?
I think it's going to be a big ask for Ulster. I think when they looked, to be fair to Ulster, you look at, like, from all the trauma on and off the field of the last 12 months, they've come a long way in a very short space of time. I think they've won two games over the course of the last two weekends against Racine in Belfast and, you know, 13-0 down against Leicester on Saturday, and they found a way to come back into it. I think last year they're probably games that they wouldn't have won. You know, it looked at one stage as if they were going to be playing Racine in Paris again, but Toulouse's effort in not killing themselves and getting the four tries, that would have given them an extra point, which keeps them in France to play against Racine in their quarterfinal, as opposed to having to play Leinster in Dublin. I think Ulster would be happier to play Leinster than having to travel to Paris to play Racine. So look, they'll be pleased with their draw. I agree with you. I think Leinster overall, they have so many strings to their bow. I mean, you look at the last try yesterday. You had Noel Reid at out half. Max Deegan in at number eight. Brilliant offload for him. And Rory O'Loughlin, the scoring pass to Reid. None of those players would be regular starters for Leinster, yet they concocted a superb try. And that's the problem with Leinster. It doesn't matter who's playing. There's a seamless game plan there. Everybody knows what's expected of them. So look, it's going to be a huge task for Ulster, but in terms of an away trip, having to go an hour and a half down the road to Dublin, I think will please them.
What about the tournament itself? Are Ireland as a nation perhaps too focused on this? You know, there's no Welsh sides there in the last eight of the competition. You know, do the French really fancy it? Where are you standing it?
Look, we're hearing all this nonsense out of England about the advantages that the Irish clubs have, but and the same at France. But those English and French clubs have massive squads. The bottom line is Exeter, I think, were unlucky not to go through. Saracens were back-to-back champions only 2 and 3 years ago. So, you know, it isn't as if you don't see French sides either rotating their squads. So, look, I just don't buy into that. There's no question from an Irish perspective. The European competition has always been the Holy Grail. Going back to Munster's quests in the late 90s, the early noughties, Leinster taking up the bat on Ulster, of course, were the first winners. So there's a history and tradition of the Irish provinces performing in Europe right from the outset. You know, I don't think... there's a cyclical thing always with this. A couple of years ago, we didn't have the Irish teams involved. It was four from France and four from England in the quarterfinal stages, and everybody felt the Irish challenge was gone for good. But, you know, that hasn't proved to be the case, and I've no doubt in another year or two, you'll see the French and the English as strong as ever. But the bottom line is Racine and Toulouse are going to be serious challengers for this year's tournament. And Saracens next to Leinster are joint favourites. So, you know, it's there's competition from all the main countries.
We can't let this go without talking about Connacht. Good day's work, said their head coach, ensuring the quarterfinal, or sorry, the Challenge Cup quarterfinal against Sale Sharks in March. But to go to France and make it 2 out of 2 in this year, it's tremendous turnaround for Connacht, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I think, look, the only disappointing thing from a supporter's point of view is, you know, with the revamped television coverage, you always had the Challenge Cup games on before. There's now a select few on, you know, so Connacht have been doing some brilliant work in the Challenge Cup, but not all of those games have been televised. So, you know, it's a pity because they've been playing out of their skins. But they've been doing so, rotating their squad as well. And, you know, they've won in France now on 2 occasions, having had some of their academy lads involved. And that has to augur well for the future. It's a pity in some respects that their quarterfinal is with Sale, given that they played them twice already in the pool stages. And Sale have been playing really well in the Premiership in England. But, like, Connacht are now fighting on 2 fronts in the Pro 14 and in the Challenge Cup to try and regain their spot in the Champions Cup for next season.
They have bounced back very well, haven't they, under Andy Friend? I mean, they really have bounced back. That looked like a province in decline not so very long ago, Connacht.
Yeah, but look, I think, to be fair, when they won the Pro 12, as it was at the time, very soon after that, you had the announcement that Pat Lam, halfway through the season, was leaving to go to Bristol. That never, you know, it never helps when you know your coach is going to leave at the end of the season. The Kieran Kane appointment just didn't seem to work. But to be fair to Andy Friend, he's picked up the baton from Pat Lam, and all the work that he has done, it's been rekindled overnight. I mean, they've made that connection with the community. They are integrating more and more young players. The average age of their squad is quite young. And, you know, players like Tom Farrell, who, you know, was in the Championship in England only 12 or 18 months ago, has now been elevated to Joe Smith's national squad. I mean, Kieran Blade from Monavay, he got his chance with Kieran Marmion out, and he's now in the Irish squad. So look, there's a huge incentive there for players. Once you perform, once you're on the stage that Connacht are on now, then anything is possible. And it's great for Irish rugby to have all 4 provinces not only competing at the level they are in Europe, but all of them competing to the strength and depth of the national squad. And, you know, it's great, and long may it continue.
Yeah, and you mentioned the national squad there. Quinn Roo in for the Six Nations squad as a replacement for Tadhg Byrne. We mentioned that he's out for at least the opening 2 games. Ian Henderson's also been declared injured finger. He could be out for the whole of the Six Nations as well. So there's 1 or 2 injury problems for Joe Smith, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. But look, if you look, John, over the course of the weekend, all the national squads for the Six Nations were announced last week. I think Eddie Jones, Gregor Townsend, Joe Schmidt, they've all had to make additions to the squad because of injuries over the weekend. It's part and parcel of the modern game. I feel sorry for Tadhg Byrne because his form has been so good over the past 2 months that you'd feel he'd have to be in the Irish, the matchday squad, yeah, at least, especially now with doubts over Ian Henderson. Then Henderson obviously came back a week or two early. He was mad at the match in the game against Leicester, but damaged his other thumb. So, you know, hugely unfortunate for him. I think it now guarantees that James Ryan and Devon Toner will start in the second row against England. And Ulton Dunnell, who's done really well to get himself back in the national squad, he'll be fighting with Quinn Roo for that place on the bench. But thankfully, Tadhg Byrne's injury, it doesn't seem to be long term. They're talking about
2 games,
him being available for the third round of games in the Six Nations. So, you know, I'm quite sure Munster fans will be thrilled to see him back as soon as possible, such as the impact that he's made with Munster this season.
Yeah, I'm also hearing Tommy O'Donnell is an injury problem too, isn't he?
Yeah, Tommy O'Donnell is another one of those players who just hasn't had a break really in the past 2 or 3 years. Initially, I think they thought it was a stinger in the game, took him off for precautionary reasons, but there's now a concern that it may be more serious than that. So that's a massive blow for him, but it seems to be a sort of a revolving door at the moment. You get one player back, you lose another. I think the biggest plus for Joe Schmidt this weekend was the sight of Sean O'Brien getting through 55 minutes for Leinster, and not only that, but playing really well, and the fact that Robbie Henshaw had 62 minutes, given that neither O'Brien or Henshaw had played since, I think, going back to Argentina in November. So, you know, you lose swings and roundabouts. You lose some players, you gain others. So, but overall, the strength of that Irish squad is really strong. So, you know, I think we're in a good position. Just, what is it, less than 2 weeks out from that opening match against England?
Yeah, I mean, the full concentration has been on the provincial game for the last couple of months leading into the end of the year and into the new year. Now, so they can put that to bed now and concentrate fully on what's going to be a massive year for Irish rugby, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Look, the Six Nations, obviously, it's a massive tournament in its own right, but in the background, you have the World Cup. It's in every player's mind, even though they don't want to admit it. But such is the competition within the Irish squad at the moment. There's only two places on that plane for the World Cup. So if you get an opportunity in the Six Nations, you have to grab it with both hands. I think it's going to be a fascinating Six Nations this year because England have a lot of the players that were injured last year back in their squad. Wales are ranked third in the world, even though their provincial sides never seem to perform in Europe. As a national squad, they're always there and thereabouts. And the fact that Ireland have to travel to Wales, that's going to be a huge game, particularly with Warren Gatland in his last season as Welsh coach. And Scotland, I mean, it's incredible. Two of their two district sides in the last eight in Europe. Gregor Townsend again doing a brilliant job there. So Scottish rugby is also on a high. So look, it's going to be, I think, one of the most competitive Six Nations in years, and really looking forward to it.
Yeah. Was Joe Smith right to make the announcement that he was going after the World Cup? Should he have left it till later, maybe?
I don't think so. I think he was right because the speculation has been there now for some time, at least by doing it, you know, when he did in the immediate aftermath of the November series. It got it out of the way. You know, I was talking earlier about coaches leaving mid-season, you know, which never seems to work, but it's different at international level. Club level, you know, you're in there day after day. The players know that Joe Schmidt, the fact that he's leaving the Irish job after the World Cup, isn't going to impact one bit in terms of the work ethic or the effort that he's going to put into, you know, the quest to get Ireland into a first ever semi-final in that World Cup. So they know he's going to perform, so it's up to the players to perform as well. I don't think it'll have any bearing on performances.
That's the benchmark, though, isn't it? You know, Ireland have only got to the quarterfinals. It's get beyond that, isn't it? You know, there are talks about, you know, possibly winning
it,
but the first thing is get to the semi-final.
Yeah, World Cups. Yeah, I mean, they've never got there in any. I think you look back to 2011 in New Zealand when we'd beaten Australia in the pool stages. At Wales in the quarterfinal, and you know, I think that particular group of players, you talk to them now, and really, if they could rewind the clock, that's a game they'd love to play again. But that's the thing with the World Cup, it's all, you know, in the here and now. You have to perform when you get your opportunity, and you know, Ireland have a decent draw, but that said, either way, you're going to end up playing either New Zealand or South Africa in a quarterfinal. Mm. So we've no divine right to think that we can turn up and just beat them. It doesn't happen like that. And you look at the improvements that Razzy Erasmus has made in a very short space of time in South Africa. So it's going to be massively challenging. I think that'll be the biggest hurdle, you know, that quarterfinal tie. If you get beyond that, anything is possible.
So the setup for the World Cup is the Six Nations, and Ireland come through winners again, perhaps, of the Six Nations. It really will set them up for the World Cup, won't it?
Yeah, well, look, you know, I don't think to be the end of the world if Ireland lost a game in the Six Nations. But you go back to England in 2003, certainly the momentum that they gained by winning the Grand Slam that year. They went to New Zealand and Australia and won two tests down there in the June before the World Cup. And that momentum really carried them through to win, you know, 2 or 3 months later. Ireland don't have the luxury, and I think quite rightly, they're not going to be involved in a tour in June. So once the Six Nations is over, really all the focus then is on that World Cup. You only have the warm-up matches, four warm-up games in August and the first week of September before they go. But, you know, those games in themselves are always difficult, are challenging for different reasons. Look, the Six Nations, that's the staging post now. And that opening game against England, an England side, Eddie Jones, is starting to fire a few bullets already, having another go off Johnny Sexton and his relationship with referees. I think we can expect more of that over the next 10 days.
Yeah, insightful stuff, as always. Donal Lenihan, thanks for joining us.
Cheers, John.
Let's go!
This is 2FM.
Game on 2FM, and in the last couple of minutes of the show, we're going to talk about Alan Colley's favourite game in National Football League. American football.
What kind of a game?
And also, perhaps not his favourite sport anymore, Shep's Eye on America on a Monday, because he's a New Orleans Saints fan, and Shep, you went down to the Rams.
John, I don't even know where to start.
You're inconsolable.
Well, look, I know you're an NFL fan, you know.
I'm a
Redskins fan.
Doesn't
yes.
make me.
Anyway. And, you know, I think initially, like, if this had happened to the Cowboys, you would enjoy it because, you know,
it's the
Cowboys.
Mm-hmm.
But then you would look at it and you'd say, well, you know, they really did get screwed and it was a really bad call and no one wins.
Now what you're talking about here, and because we have to realize the audience we have, not all NFL fans, right? Towards the end of the game, right? The Saints in position.
So the Saints are driving late in the fourth quarter, less than 2 minutes to go in the ball game, and Drew Brees throws the ball to one of his receivers, Tommy Lee Lewis. Rams defensive back he admits it.
Roby Coleman takes him out of the game, basically.
Right. He was beaten on the play, and so he basically just threw himself at Tommy Lee Lewis and interfered with him before the ball got there and hit him helmet to helmet.
In a match sense.
Yeah. Yes, and then there was two officials both standing within 10 yards of the play, and neither one of them threw a flag. And it was blatant. It was done on purpose. It was a smart move by the defensive back because he was beat, because if the ball is completed, it's a touchdown. So he's thinking, well, I'll just take the penalty, and then maybe they kick the field goal, but I won't give up a touchdown. Well, no flag was thrown. And so the Saints kick a field goal, and the game goes into overtime, and the Rams wind up winning it. And, you know, credit to them. I mean, they hit a 57-yard field goal in overtime.
Because the Saints had their chances because they dropped the ball, basically, and the Rams got the ball back and kicked the winning field goal.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, credit to Greg Zuerlein. He hits a 57-yard field goal in overtime. It's a great kick. But to just be in that position, Sean Payton, the Saints head coach, is on the sideline. You know, he said to the referee afterwards, he says, you just missed a Super Bowl call. You know, I mean, the Saints could have won the game in overtime. Absolutely. They didn't. It was just a blatant, you know, miss by the officials. Yeah. I kept thinking back, you know, kind of getting ready for today's discussion with you. It was the Thierry Henry handball that wasn't called that kept Ireland out of the World Cup, you know?
I can't think of the guy's name. He was a cricket player one time. He dropped a catch, and some guy said, what's it feels like to drop the World Cup? Something along those lines. Anyway, you know, so it was quite actually heavy. Listen, time is actually against us here, so I'm sorry for your troubles, but the Rams are there, and they're going to play Tom Brady. The GOAT, the greatest of all time.
That's right.
There's been some amazing quarterbacks down the years. Brett Favre, Terry Bradshaw, who played for Pittsburgh Steelers, Doug Williams for Washington.
For your Redskins.
For the Redskins. One of the last times he won it. More recently, Aaron Rodgers, Brett Favre, I mentioned. Jim Kelly down the years, John Elway. But Brady is the best. 9 Super Bowls, and what an extraordinary way to do it.
Yeah, I mean, this will be his 9th. A great job last night. He leads the Patriots to a win in overtime on the road in Kansas City in just a bitterly freezing game, and his clearly his best performance of the season. They looked really good. So he's 5-3 in Super Bowls all time. Looking for that 6th. He's already got more wins than anybody else in Super Bowl history. The whole thing got kicked off with a Rams-Patriots Super Bowl in New Orleans, and now it'll be Rams-Patriots in Atlanta. And,
2 weeks, He'll have another chance. I love the game. I think it's fantastic. Anyway, this is Brady. He's an old man, don't forget. This is what he had to say after the game to one of his fellow players from New England.
You're too old, man. You're too slow.
We got no skill players. We got no defense. We got nothing. Unreal, bro.
Yeah, we're too old. We're too slow. We got nothing. And we're in the Super Bowl.
He really enjoyed himself last night after that game.
Please don't let them win it. But please don't let them win it. I couldn't take another Patriots win. I'm sorry. I saw somebody tweeting. I think it was Hugh McKenna tweeting yesterday. This is the kind of stuff that Alex Ferguson's United used to engender with people when they kept winning all the time.
Right.
I don't want the Patriots to win. Please don't let the Patriots win. Anyway, just before we finish, the Rams are going to use their old uniform, I believe, in the Super Bowl. So they're going to go
back
to
yellow
and blue.
Yeah, and I hope they get killed. I hope they get killed in their old uniforms.
Let it go, man.
Let it go, John. Are you kidding me?
You were at the game yesterday, weren't you?
I did go, yes. It was terrible.
Oh, I know. I feel sorry for you, but it was absolutely fantastic. And it's as usual, the conference games are usually better than the Super Bowl itself, you know, so... which is fantastic. Anyway, look, time's against us. We've run out of time. Shep, thanks for joining us, and console yourself, man. Sorry about that.
And appreciate it, brother. Thanks,
man. There's always next season. So the Rams against the Patriots, and you'll be shouting for who, Alan?
The Rams.
Good man. Until the next time we meet, I'm John Kenny. Hope you enjoy the show. Louise is next. Good luck. Hear it. See it. Live it. Go. 2FM.